From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College.
This is
War News Radio.
I'm Caroline Batten.
And I'm Chloe Wittenberg.
This week on War News Radio, documenting war, we hear about a new documentary, Shepherds of Helmand.
This really follows six soldiers. And then as much as possible, used all of their photographs and film to, when they're talking about something, to take you there. Again, it feels very authentic, because it is. I mean, taking a camera over myself would have been gorgeous, right, with a nice high-definition camera and all that. But I'd also suggest that it wouldn't be as authentic. These guys with NOAA cameras on them. So a year later, they actually hadn't been back quite a year when they agreed to sit down with me and tell me their stories. So I got 30 hours of interviews and then 10,000 photos and, I don't know, 20 or 30 hours of video to sift through and just try to make a living document of their experience.
Then we talked to veterans coping with traumatic brain injury and their families.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Raymond Davis, a CIA contractor who shot two men in Pakistan, was released this week. The U.S. government had claimed that Davis was working at the American embassy in Pakistan and had diplomatic immunity. Davis's release was secured by a payment of blood money to the families of the men killed. Media estimates placed the sum at just over $2 million. The incident highlighted tense relations between the U.S. and Pakistan, a critical ally in the war in Afghanistan.
A car bomb in the northern Iraqi city of Kirkuk killed three people and wounded 35 others, including seven policemen, outside a government building and hospital. Police spokesmen believe the attack was aimed at Kirkuk's director of water and sewage, a Kurdish minister. The city has been the center of ongoing ethnic conflict and territorial dispute between Kurds and Arabs in the region for years.
Abdul Rahman Mustafa and Reis Karaziz, two Kurdish officials, resigned from government positions in the northern city of Kirkuk. Arab politicians have openly speculated that the move is an attempt to challenge Arab control of the city. Because Mustafa and Aziz will be replaced by Turkmen, many also believe that the move represents a political deal between Kurdish and Turkmen representatives. Recently, Kirkuk received national attention when hundreds took to the streets of Baghdad to demand President Jalal Talabani's resignation after he called Kirkuk a Jerusalem for the Kurds. U.S. forces are concerned that turmoil in Kirkuk could easily spill over to the rest of the country.
Several thousand protesters gathered in Iraq's Sadr city to march in support of the Shiite protesters in Bahrain. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and his ruling Iraqi National Alliance bloc have publicly criticized Saudi Arabia's intervention in Bahrain. Influential Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr also called for demonstrations in Baghdad. Since Iraq is one of the few Middle Eastern countries where Shiites outnumber Sunnis, the arrival of Sunni Saudi Arabian troops in Bahrain has created strong opposition in Iraq and increased sectarian tensions.
After months of debate, President Hamid Karzai has shut down eight private security firms in Afghanistan. The move is part of Karzai's attempt to remove private security companies over the next 12 months and replace them with government organizations such as the Afghan Public Protection Force and the Ministry of Defense. Some private security firms have been under fire in Afghanistan for committing major offenses such as evading taxes and violating weapons laws.
The international community is helping to plant over 400,000 trees in Afghanistan. The push to reforest coincides with Afghanistan's celebration of Nowruz, the Persian New Year. In order to use species native to the region, the trees have been bought from local Afghan vendors. The goal of the program is to increase forest coverage in Afghanistan from 2% to 5%.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon asked the UN Security Council to extend the mandate of the UN's mission in Afghanistan for another year. In his report, Mr. Ban stressed the importance of increasing Afghan sovereignty. He also noted challenges for the Afghan government, including Afghanistan's troubled financial system and last year's tainted elections.
Commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, General David Petraeus, announced this week the beginning of an investigation into the deaths of two Afghan civilians. The two boys were killed in Kunar province as part of a NATO airstrike targeting two insurgents. The helicopter crew responsible for the deaths has been grounded, and Petraeus and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates have each issued statements of apology. The incident comes just 2 weeks after a similar strike, in which 9 boys were killed while gathering firewood, also in Kunar province. Civilian deaths have been a major point of contention between the U.S. and Afghanistan. The Afghan Rights Monitor reports that at least 390 civilians have been killed since the beginning of 2011.
Petraeus also hinted that some combat troops in Afghanistan will be pulled back in July. No official decisions or numbers have been released concerning the withdrawal. Petraeus has yet to make any concrete recommendations to President Obama and is still exploring other options. Along with combat troops, many supporting troops and engineers are expected to return home. However, Petraeus has also predicted intensified combat this summer.
Army Sergeant Jeffrey Sarver, who contends that the Oscar-winning film The Hurt Locker was based on his military experience, has sued the makers of the movie, including screenwriter Mark Boal and director Kathryn Bigelow. He alleges the movie triggered doubts about his bomb-dismantling capabilities. Sarver also claimed that Boal, who exclusively shadowed Sarver in 2004, falsely portrayed him as an irresponsible and unpredictable soldier. He initially sued prior to the 2010 Academy Awards, but only recently gave testimony from his current base in Afghanistan. The team behind the Hurt Locker is looking to dismiss the case, claiming that Sarver was not the inspiration behind the protagonist of the film.
In a speech made to conservatives in Iowa, Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour recently criticized current U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. Barbour, a potential 2012 presidential candidate, suggested that the U.S. draw back troop levels in response to a diminished al-Qaeda threat. He also called for sharp decreases in the Pentagon budget and advised the U.S. not to attempt to shape Afghanistan into a Western-style democracy. President Obama's 2010 proposal to increase troop levels in Afghanistan had firm support from conservatives, but Barbour's criticism is the latest in a string of conservative attacks on Afghanistan policy.
The ongoing conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan have spawned numerous war documentaries. Gary Mortensen's 2007 film, This Is War, Memories of Iraq, was critically acclaimed for focusing on the soldiers' perspectives. Director Mortensen's new documentary, Shepherds of Helmand, uses this same approach to tell the story of an Oregonian National Guard unit deployed to Afghanistan in 2008. Alan Zhao and Jared Nolan have more.
When we got there, Shawali was talking to me, and one of the things that he said to me that struck me funny, he says, "Tell me, Captain, tell me, what will you tell me about war?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm not here to tell you about war, so I'm here to teach you how to do all this stuff." He says, "Really?" He says, "Well, let me give you some of my background. I fought against the Russians for 8 years in the Russian-Afghan war, and then I fought against the Taliban in the Afghan Civil War. And for the past 3 years, I've been fighting for you Americans against the Taliban. Now tell me, Captain, what will you tell me about war?"
That's from the trailer of the recently released documentary Shepherds of Helmand. Speaking was Major Dominic Odo, one of 17 volunteers from the Oregon National Guard deployed to Afghanistan. The film was directed by Gary Mortensen, whose vision was to produce the most authentic portrayal of a soldier's experience in Afghanistan. He accomplished this goal in two ways. First, the film did not include any on-location camera work by Mortensen. Rather, the soldiers themselves captured all the video. Then, back in the United States, Mortensen talked to the guardsmen directly for their commentary on the events they recorded. Mortensen describes the process.
"This really follows 6 soldiers. And then, as much as possible, used all of their photographs and film to, when they're talking about something, to take you there. again, it feels very authentic because it is. I mean, taking a camera over myself would have been gorgeous, right, with a nice high-definition camera and all that. But I'd also suggest that it wouldn't be as authentic. These guys with NOAA cameras on them. So a year later, they actually hadn't been back quite a year when they agreed to sit down with me and tell me their stories. So I got 30 hours of interviews and then 10,000 photos and, I don't know, 20 or 30 hours of video to sift through and just try to make a living document of their experience.
The footage is even more immediate because soldiers didn't know their video would be used in a documentary. It's simply what they felt should be recorded. First Sergeant David Hagen, one of the six soldiers featured in the documentary, explains the soldiers' motivation behind capturing the war.
Partly because we wanted something to keep. Part of it was morbid curiosity. And to be honest with you, there are a couple of those pieces of film that were taken quite literally because we ran out of ammunition. We're waiting for an ammo resupply, so in the absence of anything better to do, we filmed the war.
In earlier wars, this type of documentation simply wasn't possible, according to Mortensen.
Almost every soldier that goes over there has some form of recording device now. And what you're getting, in my opinion, with the YouTube generation now, is you're getting the most raw and authentic glimpse into the life of a soldier that we've ever had. We're getting to see things from a soldier's perspective that we've only hinted at in the past.
All of the guardsmen in the unit volunteered to deploy to Afghanistan. Sergeant Hagen describes his decision to volunteer as a simple fulfillment of mission.
Volunteered to go to Afghanistan because regardless of what my beliefs on Iraq were, I believe that Afghanistan was a just war. And personally speaking, we wear a uniform for one reason and one reason only, and that is to deploy. And I was an infantry instructor. I was training soldiers to go serve in the role of infantry in a wartime environment. So I didn't feel that it was fair for me to I couldn't give them a fair assessment and a fair shake as an instructor until I had been there and knew what I was talking about. So I volunteered to go over, one, because I felt it was a just war. Two, I think that the only reason that we're in the military is in the absence of diplomacy, we're used to deploy. And we shut down the aggression. That is our job. And I truly believe that the Afghan war was something that I needed to do.
Once there, the unit quickly realized the dangers of their mission to train an Afghan battalion and establish a presence in Helmand.
Almost every day they were attacked. And the Taliban had the base ranged in with mortars so they could mortar it whenever they wanted. In fact, to make it even worse, they believed that at least 10 of the 125 Afghan soldiers in their base were Taliban, including the company commander. The Taliban are also fanatically committed to seeing one of these bases overrun. And the interpreters have ICOM radios, and they could hear the Taliban chatting, and they're casually talking about we're going to go up and overrun that base and kill everybody.
Both military and civilian viewers have voiced positive responses. Sergeant Hagen describes the difference between the two audiences.
The military community have got a tremendous response from a lot of people saying they heard that our experiences over there were pretty dramatic, and after they saw the film, they've given certain praise to the fact that we made it out of there alive. And the reaction I've gotten from civilians were they had no idea that was going on over there.
For Mortensen, the approval of a general audience was not the most important reaction.
With this film, that there's really only six people I've ever really cared that they approve of, and that's the six guys in the film. And I told them if it's not authentic to them, then I won't release it. If it's not authentic to them, if there's something that I portray that is not accurate, then I'll fix it. Because it's their story, not mine.
Sergeant Hagen believes that Shepherds of Helmand is a story of men, without any overarching messages.
I think it's a message of 17 Oregonians going over there, and it's really just our experience. Each one of us had a different experience, and each of us came home with different perspectives. But really, it's just not the day in the life of a soldier, but the experiences in a wartime environment, how we bond together and how we live together and how we changed from beginning to end.
Mortensen says he believes it is this unfiltered focus that allows the film to be more accessible by a civilian audience.
I want people to be open-minded when they watch a film like this. You know, it's a war film. It's a documentary, but it's really, I didn't make it to be a war film. I made this about Americans. It's about our neighbors. It's about our family. And something that they've done that's quite extraordinary. I'm a big believer that, you know, the soldiers need to have a voice. They need to be heard. And so many times we're hearing someone else is speaking on behalf of the soldiers. You know, they're saying this is what they're doing, this is what they're thinking, or this is what's going on. Well, you know, I just want to hear from the soldiers.
Shepherds of Helmand is not currently commercially distributed, but it can be ordered from the film's website, shepherdsofhelmand.org. Half of the revenue from the film goes to Honored American Veterans Afield, a nonprofit organization dedicated to sponsoring outdoor sports events for disabled veterans. For War News Radio, with Alan Zhao, I'm Jared Nolan.
This is War News Radio. More than a fifth of the wounded from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have traumatic brain injuries. Once they get home, their journey has only just started. Emily Hager spoke with two families, one in Nebraska and one in Texas, about their experiences dealing with TBI. This piece first aired in August of 2009.
Jason Tarash served two tours of duty in Iraq, first from 2005 to 2006, and then again in 2007. He was hit by six IEDs.
I think it's the scariest thing I've ever gone through in my life. The first one, it went off and our whole truck just about flipped, and everything just turned black, and you could just see fire and just hear shrapnel just ripping through your vehicle.
He was hit four times on the first tour, three of the times in 1 week, and twice on his second tour. Then he was sent home with a serious case of PTSD. But the IED explosions injured his brain. He says he knew something was wrong after the very first blast.
After the first IED hit, it felt like, man, it felt like my eyeballs just kept screaming back and forth without me being able to control it. And I was just getting so dizzy, and I couldn't handle it. So then I got hit again. After that, I can't even take a shower. I have to take a bath. If I take a shower, my wife's got to be in the shower with me to help me stand up because I can't close my eyes.
He says the Army didn't recognize TBI at that time, and his commanders kept sending him out.
I even tried to talk to the section sergeant, Sergeant Collins, tell him, look, I need a break from the road. No, you know, we leave in 4 hours, you're going.
His job was dangerous. He drove in the lead truck in the convoys, keeping a watch out for IEDs so they wouldn't hit the rest of the group. He would call his wife, Trisha, back at home and tell her about it.
He told me many times how, you know, he had to take a driver and kind of put him back together in like a jigsaw puzzle in a body bag because there just wasn't, you know, or just pick up the pieces that you found, but what you found wasn't, you know, recognizable as a man. He told me many things like that, which usually were very disturbing to me, but I always wanted him to feel that he could tell me anything that he wanted to.
Trisha says he never should have been approved to go back to Iraq for the second tour because of his brain injury. But he vows he would do it the same way again.
The best way to say it is I'm just a diehard patriot. I mean, I loved being there. I loved doing my job. It hurts sometimes, especially with the IEDs and stuff like that. So I took great pride in my work.
Jason had been in the Army since he left high school in 1998, but he didn't deploy to Iraq till 2005. That was also the year that Corporal Stephen Schultz was hit by the IED that changed his life. Stephen Schultz served in Iraq with the Marine Corps from December 2003 to July 2004, then went back in January 2005. On his second tour, he was a truck commander who sat in the passenger seat of an unarmored Humvee. On April 19th, the phone rang at home. His mother, Debbie, answered.
So I pick it up and this gruff voice says, Mr. Schultz? Yes. This is a gunnery sergeant and I don't remember his name right offhand, but he said, are you sitting down? And, you know, in my mind, I'm going, oh, God, this is the Marines. He can't be dead because I don't see a blue suit at the door. He's reading verbatim this, I guess, the telegraph that they got or something. And it's Lance Corporal Stephen Schultz has received a VSI. And I'm going, wait, what's a VSI? Very serious injury, man. This. And by that time, you know, I've written very seriously injured on my piece of paper. My husband's reading that. And he's wailing on the floor, just losing it, basically. And I'm like, oh, I can't believe this is happening, you know.
Stephen had taken a piece of shrapnel through his right eye and into the frontal lobe of his brain. He was flown to Germany, then to Bethesda, Maryland. Debbie says he was essentially uninjured from the neck down, but his entire left side was paralyzed. The doctors gave him a 50-50 chance of survival. It was up and down, touch and go, for weeks. The first thing Stephen remembers after the blast was 8 weeks later. He was still in the hospital.
I remember getting my Purple Heart at Bethesda by the Commandant of the Marine Corps, the highest ranking officer in the Marine Corps. It was very cool, great feeling.
He started to get better, but 90% of his right frontal lobe had been removed.
And that's part of the brain that sort of tells us who we are and gives us our social graces and ability to plan or execute what we want to do. And because that personality center got damaged, his affect is very flat.
She says at first he just wanted to stay in bed. Now, 4 years later, he's partly regained the use of his leg, and he's beginning to heal. He still has his sense of humor. The thing he misses most? Driving.
Because it's what I did. I thought it was giving me a lot of freedom in the world.
Jason Chirosh doesn't drive anymore either. It's partly the PTSD. He says he drives like he's still in Baghdad, and he yells at his wife to avoid suspicious potholes. But it's partly the TBI. Once, he left for an appointment a few minutes away and ended up in Kentucky. He had no idea how he'd gotten there. Now, he spends most of his time being a stay-at-home dad to his son and daughter. His friend John comes over as well.
We have a 10-month-old daughter, and when she was born, John was here every day from 8 a.m. till pretty much so 8 at night, helping me take care of my newborn, because I couldn't do it.
Jason's short-term memory is very bad.
Me and my wife, we argue a lot because she'll tell me something, and then 10 minutes later, I'll straight up forget about it.
It's very hard to get in a fight with someone, to go to bed angry, and to wake up and realize that he doesn't remember what you were fighting about, but you're still angry about it. So he doesn't understand why you're angry.
Tricia says he also gets angry a lot more quickly than he did before, and the PTSD has disrupted both their lives. During the day, when he says he doesn't want to go out, and during the night.
I got dragged under the bed one time because he was for sure we were being mortared, and it took me 2 hours to convince him that we were not being mortared and it was only a dream.
Jason says it hurts to know that he'll never be able to have the life he'd planned on. He thought he'd be in the military for 30 years. But that's no longer an option. Both families also say they've had their share of troubles with the VA. Debbie thinks Stephen got good care in Bethesda, but once they got home to Texas, the VA system, set up to handle older patients, had trouble meeting their needs. Just providing a health worker to stay with Stephen so Debbie could get a few hours off each week was complicated.
Once you got outside of that Washington area, and we got back to Texas, it's almost like we sort of dropped off the side of the earth. This was, of course, 05, and a lot of changes have been made since then because there were lots of families that have jumped up and down and changed the system.
Jason Chirosh has had issues with the VA, too. Most of his doctors are civilians.
I think the VA system's garbage. I think it is. And the VA, I mean, they really didn't do anything. You know, you go in there, you tell them what's wrong, they give you some morphine and send you home. My wife carries our health insurance because I refuse to go to the VA.
Tricia finds it hard sometimes, being in a town that's not full of military families.
When you have a soldier that comes back home and they're missing a body part, everyone that sees them recognizes that because they can see it with their eyes and they can see that they're injured. But when you have a soldier with PTSD or with TBI, there's nothing that you can see with your eyes. They look perfectly normal on the outside. but they are very damaged and they are very hurt. And some people don't understand what the big deal is. Some people, well, he looks normal, what's the problem?
Both Debbie and Tricia have reached out through the internet to others going through similar experiences.
I was talking to another mom just 2 days ago, and her son has a brain injury, and he is unable to talk, though. She was saying how much she missed her son. And she said, you miss your old Stephen, don't you? And I said, well, yes. Yes, I think, you know, anybody whose son has a major or daughter has a major life event like this has to go through that grieving process of you've lost what was. And it's devastating in a way. But then you also have to, you know, decide, am I going to stay in grief about what was, or do I want to march forward? And I decided pretty early on that I was going to look forward.
Tricia says she, too, believes in the saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Sometimes it's very trying. Sometimes it's very hard, very heart-wrenching, and you just cry a lot. But, you know, I always think that all of this is preparing my children for a life where they could handle anything.
These families are just two of the thousands who are now beginning their lives after devastating traumatic brain injuries. For War News Radio, I'm Emily Hager.
Army Sergeant Travis M. Tompkins from Lawton, Oklahoma, was killed by a rocket-propelled grenade in Logar Province, Afghanistan this week. Sergeant Tompkins had received a Bronze Star and Purple Heart. He deployed to Afghanistan in October of 2010. Sergeant Tompkins was 31 years old and is survived by his parents, wife, and two children. Week. War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Kate Aronoff, Anjali Kadambi, Emily Bryant, Paige Grandpre, Sam Hirschman, Louis Katz, Rosanna Kim, Jared Nolan, and Alan Zhao. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Chloe Wittenberg.
And I'm Caroline Batten. Until next time, thanks for listening.